Welcome, everybody, to Hacks and Jacks. Unfortunately, our good friend Joe Galina is out with health issues. He's had health issues all year, so if you have any good thoughts to send his way, please do that. In the meantime, you have me, Scott Chu. I'll be joining along with a very special guest, Sarah Sanchez of Bleed Cubby Blue, and, of course, one of our own Pitcher List podcast hosts and extraordinaires. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And Scott, I'm so excited to be here with you because you were our first guest on Fantasy Feud and just absolutely thrilled to return the favor. Looking forward to talking hitters with you.
Yeah. I'm excited too. I was glad that you kind of mentioned you were free. I was like, oh, found who I'm bringing on. This is going to be a lot of fun. What I really want to talk about today, especially just with the context of where we are in the season, you know, it's the end of April. You know, we're recording right now. It's about 10:30 PM Eastern time, on April 28th. It's Sunday. So hopefully there's not any breaking news by the time we finish recording this and the time, y'all listen to it on Monday morning, but you never know. Either way, what I really want to talk about now that it's the end of April is I want to talk about streaks and slumps. Like, that's really going to be the theme for the whole episode. Usually Joe does these shows and scripts and he's got it all set up. I had to pick a theme because I'm not creative enough to just bounce around every. So I want to talk about streaks and slumps. I want to talk about players who are doing well, who aren't. But to start us off, before we start breaking down into the players, which we're going to do a lot of this episode, I really just kind of want to start out talking about, like, sort of the meta discussion of streaks and slumps, you know? And I think what I want to start with, Sarah, is, do you have any specific tools you like to use when you're looking at players who are streaking or slumping? You know, they show up on your waiver wire because you're looking at recent results, or they've been on your team and they're really not doing well and you want to dig in more. Where do you go? What do you do?
This is going to sound so old school and, like, ridiculous, and definitely apologies to Nick Pollock, who was just recently on Fantasy Feud and reminded me that I should use Pitcher List stats more. But honestly, my best friend when it comes to streaks and slumps is Babbitt. I want to know immediately, is this something that is within career norms? Is this something that is the result of, like, a player decline? Or is this something that is just baseball gonna baseball, right? And Babbitt is your best friend for figuring out baseball gonna baseball. If a guy is in his low 30s, has a career 315 BABIP, and all of a sudden is sporting like a 173 BABIP with no injury news for the last couple of months, like, that is luck. That is randomness. That is just what happens in baseball sometimes. And you should write it out. Like, as long as the hard hit numbers are good, as long as the strikeout rate hasn't climbed precipitously, like, as long as things haven't gotten out of control in some other way, BABIP is your best friend for figuring out, is this just random variant? And we are still, despite the fact that it's like 4 weeks into the season and it feels like we have real numbers and real data, we are still in the realm of batted ball luck can happen. And there are a lot of guys who are either way over their skis or not performing to expectations solely based on the luck of the base. So BABIP is one of the first places I go. And obviously with a fact check of, did the strikeout rate increase? Why? Did the hard hit rate decrease? Why? Like, there are other metrics that inform how you evaluate that. But I really do believe that BABIP could be your best friend here.
No, I love that. You know, I think what I love that phrase, baseball gonna baseball, because, you know, one of the things that really comes out this time of year is people talk about, like, when does that stat stabilize, right? Like, when does it stabilize? And the term stabilization is really important mathematically. I'm not a math guy, but I will tell you, it does not mean what you think it means, right? Like, stabilize doesn't mean, like, it doesn't change anymore, right? It doesn't mean that now it's flat. It just means that these stats are probably reliable based on the data that we have so far, but they're not predictive. Like, stabilized does not mean predictive. It means probably an accurate representation of what's happening right now, which, as you pointed out, might just be a bunch of dumb luck, right? Good or bad. We have five players right now. Like, I think going into Sunday's action, we had five players with 100 batted ball, right? And I'm pretty sure it probably stayed that way unless Shohei Ohtani put, like, every ball he saw into play. We have five players with 100 batted balls. 100 batted balls, if you're a Statcast person, sounds like a lot, but really, it's not that big of a sample. It's not one that we love to just say, like, oh, we know everything now, right? So I know, like, right now, BABIP is a really good one. You know, I'm sure a lot of people are looking at, like, X-WOBA or X-Average and X-Slugging. And those are a great bellwether for luck, right? Like they will help you understand, like, does this player deserve the results they got, right? But that's just a starting point. I love what you said about, I start with like the BABIP to see if anything's out of whack there. The very next thing, I'm the same way. The very next thing I go to is, what do the play discipline numbers look like? Is there like a ton of weird strikeouts or like a ton of weird walks? Or is a 10% walk guy all of a sudden not walking? Like those things are big red flags to me, right? Like a player who usually strikes out 20% of the time, now striking out 30% of the time. I'm like, whoa, 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 right? Something else might be off here. So, like this slump doesn't seem like it's on its way out yet, right? Even if I think like, okay, these are all, you know, like some bad luck, but also he's striking out a lot. So there's some real problems here. I think, yeah, those are the really big things I look at. I look at the luck metrics, whichever ones you want to use, right? You can look at the difference between ex-WOBA and regular WOBA. You can look at BABIP, look at whatever you want. Find out if they're lucky and then find out if something, if they're not making contact, right? Or if something else is weird, right? They're all of a sudden not walking, all of a sudden striking out way more than they should. But when you, I think the other thing that's important is when a guy's plate discipline numbers are okay, it doesn't mean that everything's necessarily okay. But if the walks and strikeouts are in line with what we should expect for that player, that's actually a good thing, right? That means that this player is not as broken as you might think.
That's totally right. And it reminds me actually that we just recently had Jason Collette on the podcast, and he does, if you don't follow the Collette Calls column that Jason writes, you really should. It's over at RotoWire. It's great. He does a really nice job of summarizing the overall league environment early in the season. And I think that this is super useful data for people to keep in mind. So one of the things that Jason was talking about is that the ball is traveling less farthest. So there's kind of an offensive power outage in the league. There's also like stolen bases are weirdly down for a couple of reasons that I'll get into in a second. But both of those things mean the offensive environment is not as strong as it was last season. And that is going to impact different players differently. So if you're a guy who hits 450 foot bombs, that probably doesn't impact you. Like your 430 foot home run is also a home run, and your 460 foot home run is also a home run. That's fine. But there are a handful of players. We've got a couple of them on the list that we're going to talk about later who they hit 368 foot home runs. They hit them there consistently. They need that ball to be a home run, right? If all of a sudden your 368 football is a 348 football, that's an F. So one of the other things to keep in mind here in terms of not just individual player stats is also league-wide player stats. And is there anything going on due to the weather, due to the schedule, due to the physical baseball itself, due to rule changes and the environment that impacts that player's ability to do what they used to?
Yeah, I mean that's huge. And again, we will talk about a lot of these players who might just be impacting or who might just be sort of a victim of the current offensive environment. I think the one other tool I want to bring up, because I can't do a podcast without talking about rolling charts, is look at rolling charts. So one thing that rolling charts can do is help you understand, and this is, I've been preaching this about Aaron Judge for weeks now, who's finally seeming like he's turning around a little bit, but when you look at the rolling charts, the biggest thing you can do is like over the last 3 years, has this player been this bad before or have they been this good before? Is this in the normal range of outcomes? I talked about how stabilization doesn't mean flat, right? Players still have ups and downs because baseball got a baseball. That's just what happens. That's the nature of this game. It's played by humans. They do human things, which means going hot and cold. If you've done anything mildly competitive in your life for an extended period of time, you will have periods of hot and cold. I don't care if it's like rec soccer or Scrabble, right? You just have times where you're locked in or things just aren't working out. And the rolling charts really help you understand, like, is this player just in a normal slump? Like Aaron Judge has bad slumps. This bad slump we saw him in at the start of the season feels like it's the worst it's ever been. Because when you look at the stat line, you're like, he's never been this bad, which is true. He's never been that bad over a full season. He actually had stretches worse than that in 2022 when he set the AL home run record, right? Like he actually had stretches where he was not a good hitter in that season, actually worse than he had to start this season, right? Like that's just, it just the way the game works. You have like those rolling charts will really help you put a lot of that stuff in context.
I think that's totally right. And the one thing that I want to add there, this is the time of year where we overreact in ways that we should not, right? Like, I keep seeing guys on my waiver wire. I'm like, why is that guy available? It's totally bonkers. And it's because you're never going to look worse if your slump occurs at the start of the season. Like, that slump occurs in June. We don't even register it. You're building up. You've already got a 310 average and you've already got 20 home runs and everything looks great. And you have a little slump for like 3 weeks and everybody's like, whatever, that's fine. You do that in April at the start of the season. It's like, oh my God, I drafted Francisco Lindor second. He's hitting 167 and doesn't have a home run yet. That's not an actual accurate Francisco Lindor current stat. I don't have it up at the moment, but I know that was true-ish in the last couple of weeks. You overreact to small samples when they're at the very start of a season because you see them more. Like, you see Tyler O'Neill. Like, Tyler O'Neill is not going to hit 70 home runs. Come on, y'all. Like, I love Tyler O'Neill. He's great. He's one of my most rostered players. And you can't just, like, take the 9 home runs he has right now and multiply them by the rest of the season and call that Tyler O'Neill's home run total. He just happened to start high.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about this guy again a little bit later, but Christopher Morel, right? Like, this, he did the same thing when he came on to this. You know, he didn't come onto the scene last season, but when he came up for the first time last season, he immediately hits like 9 home runs. People didn't notice he slumped after that for like 2 weeks because of how good the first 2 weeks were, right? Like, it all, that's when you get all that blending together. And that's, again, where the rolling charts help you see, like, has this player been this bad? What does that look like?
Well, and I'm just spoiler alert here, but Christopher Morel is one of those guys that if you have him on your team, you should be absolutely thrilled about it. You should totally hold, because there are underlying metrics that are everything we've ever wanted from Christopher Morel, and he's getting in one.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm excited to talk about him too. Because there's a lot of interesting stats that we can kind of talk about with him. But I think the other thing I want to talk about, you know, and we've sort of talked around it a little bit, is, you know, Sarah, for you, when is a hot streak or a slump more than a hot streak or a slump?
It's a great question. I just referenced Tyler O'Neill, so I'm going to bring him back in. I don't think Tyler O'Neill is on pace for 72 home runs. That would be crazy town. But I do think Tyler O'Neill is in a great situation. He was struggling with the Cardinals. He clearly had some sort of weird beef with Ollie Marmol that none of us will ever understand. The Cardinals sold low on Tyler O'Neill. He lands in Boston, which the Red Sox are my AL team. I watch them a lot. Tyler O'Neill looks so happy to be out of St. Louis. He's just like, I like it here and they like me and this is great. And he's just hitting bombs, right? Like, he's just hitting bombs. He's doing the thing and he looks like he was born to play in Boston. Just pencil it in right now. The next time that Boston is in the ALCS, Tyler O'Neill is going to be your ALCS MVP, a la Randy Rosarena or Adelis Garcia or all of the other outfielders that the Cardinals cut bait on. He is that dude. I think that a hot streak is more than a hot streak when there are other things going on that explain why a player is surging. And in Tyler O'Neill's case, he got out of an environment where it was a really crowded outfield and he was not appreciated. He was not understood to be that guy. And here he is again. And it's like, oh yeah, remember in 2021 when Tyler O'Neill hit 34 home runs and looked like he was going to be that dude in 2022 and we all drafted him super high and then he got hurt? It looks like he's that dude. I think that's more than a hot streak. I think that alternatively, if there's something weird going on and nothing explains it, right? Like, a guy's running a 380 BABIP and he's usually run a 300 BABIP and he just happens to look really hot right now, maybe slow your roll a little bit. Like, maybe don't go all in on that particular player. But if there are real, he's got a change of scenery, he's got a change of environment, he's hitting in a different spot in the lineup can be a big one, right? Like, you go from I'm a platoon guy to I'm hitting second. Those are really big things to look at. I think you need to look at overall circumstances to see if something has structurally changed that is better for this.
Yeah, that's so critical. Like, not just the stat part, but like the human element is actually a great place to start. Like, I mean, even if you just take it more literally, instead of saying like, oh yeah, he looks like, I haven't seen him on TV, how do I know he looks comfortable in Boston? You don't need to necessarily see that. You've also know he's got a whole new coaching staff, a whole new support system around him to do something different in a place where he just could not stay healthy. He could not stay consistent. And you could tell by the end, there's a lot of frustration there because anyone who's feeling inconsistent or unsupported lose, like, changes jobs, right? Like, we all do this. Like, when we're in that situation, we want to change jobs, we get to new jobs where we're supported and we're like, oh man, I'm great. I'm good at this. Like, why didn't they respect me before? There's like there's a real thing to that. And I also like pointing out, like, you know, like for BABIP being really high, right? Like, there's a couple reasons BABIP can be really high. And one of the first things I look at to see whether a player can keep doing what they're doing is I actually look at line drive rates. So line drive rates are like the least sticky thing of all time, right? Like, very few players have consistent line drive rates. And the real number to look for is like 28% and higher, or really 25% and higher, but in smaller samples, 28% and higher, because pretty much no one in Major League Baseball can do that for very long. There's like a really small number of players who do that, because line drives, like, the difference between a line drive and a ground ball and a line drive and a fly ball, when you're talking about a round ball on a round bat, is basically nothing, right? Like, it is such a small amount of space. And so very few players consistently hit line drives. You're looking at like the Freddie Freemans and the Luis Arraez's of the world, who can do like 25 to 30% line drives over an extended period of time. Early in the season, I go and look at that to say, like, okay, you know, is this player doing something that I don't think can continue? And actually, a weird example of it is Mookie Betts. Mookie Betts will continue to be a very, very good player. Let's be very clear. But this dude has a 34.7% line drive rate and a 20.8% ground ball rate. Nobody can do that for very long, right? A month is about it. Like, those are insane numbers. Some of those line drives are going to turn into ground balls. Some of that batting average is probably going to come down a little bit. Like, that shouldn't be a surprise, right? He's not Superman. He's close, but he's not. Even though he can play second base and shortstop, he's close, but he's not. And it's going to come down a little bit. And that doesn't mean anything is wrong, right? That doesn't mean anything is broken. Like, he's getting some really good results out of this, but like, no one can keep doing that, right? And other players like sort of fit into this too throughout the season. Brandon Marsh has like a 27% line drive rate. That's unlikely to continue. We have a lot of track record on him. It's just not that high, but that's one great, like, again, another bellwether that I like to just look at and say, can this keep going? Josh Smith, another one who hitting just a boatload of line drives. And like, those are some of those, a good chunk of them are going to turn into line drives or fly balls, which are far more likely to be outs. Again, that doesn't mean they're going to be bad. It doesn't mean everything's going to fall apart. You just need to get an idea that, look, some of that is going to happen. A player's track record will tell you where those line drives are eventually going to go. Are they going to be ground balls? Are they going to be fly balls? And you'll also get a sense of, what does their success rate look like on that type of batted ball, right? Like, Josh Smith is not the kind of guy that I want hitting 10% more fly balls, right? Because he didn't hit the ball that hard. Like, he can't hit home runs constantly with all these fly balls. I actually want some of them to turn into ground balls because they have a better chance of being a hit for him. Because unless you're really strong, fly balls are outs, right? Like, that's what happens with them. So just another thing, like, so when I say, you know, like, when is a slump more than a slump? It's when everything else, you know, everything else is also falling apart, right? Like, not just the results, right? So when a slump is more than slump one, I look at the rolling chart, and if they've never been this bad before, my red flags go up, right? My ears are perked. I'm looking around being like, this player's never been this bad before for an extended period of time. What's wrong? You know, plate discipline being out of whack, that's a great place to start. Batted ball distribution, though, can also be a place where I'm like, whoa, this doesn't look quite right. Yandy Diaz breaks out last season. Why? Because in April and May, he hit a bunch of fly balls that he's never hit again, right? He never really did it before, never really did it again. Doesn't mean he's not good, but it means that 20 home runs is hard for him to get to because he needs to hit more fly balls than he's ever really hit before. He did it for a month and a half or so, and it was great. And then it went away, and he went back to being normal good, right? That was a case where I was like, a hot streak is just a hot streak. One thing is different. It's fly balls. They'll go back, and everything will be fine. If there were multiple things going on, then I'd start looking at it. Enough. So, oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I think that's totally right. Love the line drive analysis there. The other thing that I look at that is related to line drives is your hard hit rate. I want to know if you're hitting the ball as hard as you. Sometimes you hit the ball hard and that's a warning track fly and it turns into an out. Sometimes you hit the ball hard and you hit it into the ground and that's a double play. But if you're hitting the ball hard, it generally means that like the mechanics are good, right? Like your swing is doing the thing and it is impacting the ball in a way that is creating the batted ball events that are what we expect from you. I get nervous when I see a guy, and the one that comes to mind immediately, 2 years ago, I think, in draft season, I was like really into Dylan Carlson. I had Dylan Carlson on a bunch of teams. And I looked up about this time of year and it was like, the hard hit rate is tanked. Like, just, he is not hitting the ball hard at all. He has no barrels, zero barrels through, like, I don't know, 70, 80 plate appearance. And I was terrified. I tried to trade Dylan Carlson everywhere I had him because I was just like, and you know, it was not that long ago that Dylan Carlson and Tyler O'Neill were functionally the same person in drafts, right? Like, they were both Cardinals outfielders that a good team was high on, that had had a good season. And one of those guys currently is up there with the league leaders in home runs, and one of those guys is not, right? And this is no shade to Dylan Carlson personally. I have nothing against him as a human, but that hard hit rate collapse, I don't know if it was because of injury. I don't know if it was because of approach. I don't know enough about him or like the day-to-day of the Cardinals to understand exactly what happened there, but it was a harbinger of, he is not going to be able to do the thing this year. And I got out as quickly as I could in every league where I could trade him. I think that hard hit rate is similar to line drive rate in that, look, if you're hitting the ball hard still and the BABIP gods are just not smiling on you, we'll just wait that out and things are going to get better in June. But if you're no longer impacting the baseball as hard as you used to, something is wrong.
No, absolutely. And I'm glad you bring up StatCast there, because that was like the one other thing I really wanted to talk about in this first segment before we go to our first little ad break. And that's, you know, StatCast gives us so much great data. We have cool StatCast data over on Pitcher List on our player pages that brings in batted ball direction, your normal baseball savant StatCast page. It doesn't bring in batted ball direction. The difference between the two basically is like, you're being a little bit more descriptive when you bring in the batted ball direction. You're being a little bit more predictive when you leave it out, because batted ball direction is sort of fluky for a lot of players. But neither are very predictive. I tend to think of it more as descriptive, but hard hit rate is great. Cause if a guy's hitting the ball really hard and everything else looks good, like, then it's just bad luck. One little word of caution. There's a very specific player and specific player type that you don't want to panic that they're not hitting it hard. His name is Isak Paredes. Isak Paredes will have more home runs than barrel. The reason for that is because he pulls the ball like exactly down the foul line, right? And as it turns out, like, Tampa doesn't have like a famous Crawford boxes or something like they have in Houston, which is what Alex Bregman, who we might talk about a little bit later, has. But with Isak Paredes, like, it actually turns out that Tampa has like almost a little cutout in the left field wall. And I started calling it the Isak Paredes hole. This dude tries to hit the home run right into that little box. And so he can outperform his StatCast data. But the only way you know that, because StatCast is actually pretty good at telling us what, if a player is doing the basics right, are they hitting the ball hard? Are they getting robbed because they have a really good expected batting average or expected slugging? The one thing you want to keep in mind is extreme pull hitters will almost always beat their expected stats by a fairly wide margin, because they just keep ripping the ball right. Like, they don't, like, Isak Paredes will live on 350-foot home runs until he's done, right? Like, that's what he's going to do.
I am so glad you brought up Isak and Alex Bregman in the same segment, because like, one of the things, and I know we're going to talk about Bregman later, but one of the things I worry about with Bregman, that's a trick that works until it does. That's the poolside dude who is like only pulling home runs just over the wall. That works. And then all of a sudden those are out, and you really want to be careful. And this is what I was talking about earlier when I said, you know, if the ball changes a little bit and you're a Christopher Morel who hits 450-foot home runs, like, you don't care. Oh, my 450-foot home run is a 435-foot home run, and it just didn't clear the field and go to Waveland, right? Like, you're fine. Alex Bregman can't do that. Someday in the future, Isak Paredes won't be able to do that. But for now, that's a trick that works, and it works in the park that he's in. And as long as the trick is working, you're fine. Isak Paredes, famously traded by the Chicago Cubs along with Jamer Candelario for 2 months of Alex Avila and Justin Wilson. We'll never get over that trade. Sorry, had to do a Cubs thing.
I am so glad you brought up an Isak Paredes trade that you can't get over, because the Tigers went and traded Isak Paredes for Austin Meadows and got him for basically no time at all. Isaac Paredes became a Ray, and nobody got anything for it, right? Two trades to get him from the Cubs to Tampa. No one got anything for it except for the Rays, because darn it, they're the Rays. That's just what they do. But yeah, so we've talked a lot about streaks and slumps. I think really the thing is, like, look for the thing that's wrong. Like, which of these things is not like the other? What is this player doing or not doing that they used to do, or that they've never done before? Like, that's really what you're looking for. And it notice that we did not once talk about home runs, doubles, batting average, OBP. Like, we didn't talk about those things because those are all just results. And results are, being hot means you get good results. Being cold means you don't have good results. That's just the nature of what those things mean. You got to look beyond that a little bit to see, like, again, is he hitting the ball hard? Is he just kind of randomly hitting more line drives than usual that are going to turn into something? Are they striking out a lot more than they really should be? Like, those are the things you really want to look for, not just the results. But if you do want to look at results, look at those rolling charts. See if they've had these bad results before, for any extended period of time. If this is the best ever or worst ever, then you might want to pay a little more attention. That doesn't mean, again, that it's going to continue. It doesn't mean that this is what it's going to be like for the rest of time. It just means that this is something new. This is something different. We should take a look at it. We're going to go into a whole bunch of players. We're going to start with the bad news, the guys who aren't hitting very well. Then we're going to go into the good news. But before then, we are going to take a quick commercial break. So we will be back right after this. And we are back. I'm here with Sarah Sanchez. We're talking about streaks and slumps. We just kind of went over all the meta stuff. Like, what is a streak? What is a slump? All that great stuff. Now I want to talk about players that are actually in the thick of it. We are going to start with the bad news so we can end with the good news. We're going to start with players who are slumping. Just before I do that, I want to go through two quick lists. And these are players who, I'll start with the players who were slumping in April of last year. Then I'll go to the players who are doing well in April of last year. Just again, to put some context on this, right? To remind you that none of this stuff is forever. We are all on this spinning rock near our sun that will one day evaporate. None of it is permanent. I'll start with players. These are players who had a WRC plus below 80 at the end of April. This means they were 20% worse than the average MLB player last April for that whole month, who are not actually bad. I'll actually lead off Bobby Witt Jr. His WRC plus was like 74. He was quite bad to start the year. Tristan Cassis, Lane Thomas, Anthony Santander, George Springer, Nolan Arenado, Trey Turner, Lewis Robert Jr., Josh Naylor, and Ha-Seong Kim. All of them stank in April last year. All of them. All of them ended up being good. All of them ended up being useful. They were just slumps, right? And we had the same conversations we're going to have through the rest of this episode about these players, right? I'll also quickly bring up some players who were good. They had a WRC plus of at least 130 in April 2023. They were 30% better than the average major leaguer. There were many people who thought, hey, these guys, they're always going to be good because they're being so good. And it wasn't the case, such as Brandon Marsh, Jared Kelenic, the guy who keeps coming back from the dead, Connor Joe, Patrick Wisdom, Austin Hayes, Jeff McNeil, Rodolfo Castro, Hunter Renfro, and Rowdy Tellez. All of these guys were extremely relevant last April and really not ever again, right? For more than just little bits here and there, because if you're good enough to be in the major leagues, you're good enough to go on a hot streak. Like, that's just really the way it works. And the pitchers are good enough to put you on a cold streak. All of that can happen for every single player. And I especially want to call out Connor Joe, because Connor Joe will keep doing this. We'll probably talk about him. Like, he replaced Colin Moran, who did the same stupid thing, who went to Pittsburgh, was good every April and never good again. But Connor Joe is a guy who can hit lefties, and he's really good at it. And he's just going to keep doing it over and over and over again.
It's so funny that you bring up Connor Joe, because I'm truly just like, I don't know, man, maybe just draft Connor Joe with one of your last picks and like leave him in there until he turns into a pumpkin. I picked up Connor Joe in Tout Wars, where I had Nathaniel Lowe start the season with an injury. And I was just like, well, I need a corner and Connor Joe is hot, so I'm just going to ride this until it's not working anymore. And frankly, it's still working enough that in a 15 team league, I'm like, yeah, let's hang on to Connor Joe for a little bit.
Yeah, like, let's be clear, I'll call out some of these players as not actually being like top 150 hitters. You do not have to be a top 150 hitter to help somebody's fantasy team for 2 weeks, 3 weeks. You don't, right? You just have to be in a good situation and you have to be hitting okay. It is absolutely okay to go find a hot guy and ride it till it dies. The thing is, you have to be ready to let go, right? You have to be ready to push Jack off the floating door or whatever you're on in the ocean, push him off and then go to safety, because these guys, they won't help you for that long.
I'm going to try so hard to not derail this whole podcast with my rant about Titanic, but that is one of the worst movies ever. The only redeeming factor is the unsinkable Molly Brown. Great. And I still to this day do not understand why Jack couldn't get on the little like flat thing. Like it could have helped both of them. It could have helped both of them. I don't know why he had to die. It's the most ridiculous like moment in movies of all time. And I can't believe it beat Good Will Hunting for Best Picture, but that's fine.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Because it's because it had more money. And you know, a nude drawing, I'm pretty sure.
Anyway, sorry. You're here for hitters, not movie and elf.
Two VHS tapes. That's the thing I remember the most. But yeah, so let's talk about some current slumping players. And the context I want to put this in isn't do they suck, right? Because they probably don't, right? Like I picked a bunch of players who probably don't entirely stink. What I really want to talk about in the context of both, you know, 12, 15 team leagues, you're just talking about different contexts for the type of player that we're talking about. But, you know, are you leaving them in your lineup? Are you benching them? When, you know, are you thinking about cutting them? Right. So we'll start with just a group of players. I'll sort of go first. I'll talk about the one that I think is on everybody's mind, and that's Corbin Carroll. Corbin Carroll, Arizona Diamondbacks. He's starting out really, really poorly. We saw the power actually start to evaporate for Corbin Carroll a little bit at the end of last season. There's a lot of speculation that his shoulder is no good. He is still running, but he's not doing a whole lot else. He's moved down in the order from like second to seventh. There's a lot of panic right now about Corbin Carroll. And I think most of you, if you're smart enough to be able to like use your digits and download a podcast, you're probably not cutting Corbin, right? You're smart enough to know that I shouldn't do that. The real question becomes, are you leaving him in your lineup or are you benching him? And I will say this. I can't answer that question for you entirely because I don't know what's on your bench. Am I benching Corbin Carroll for Connor Joe? Not very often, right? Because what's going to happen is, I mean, we actually just saw this with a player who is much less than Corbin Carroll, but it's Zidane Rafaela. And he just hit like two home runs. He had like seven RBI in one game. That's sort of extreme, but like the types of players that can do that are more like the Corbin Carrolls of the world. So we have absolutely no metric that will tell us when a slump will begin and when it will end, right? We do not know exactly when that's going to happen. There's no metric that can help you understand when it's going to happen. All we can do is say there are things going on that make it seem like it's more likely to continue or less likely to continue, but there's nothing that says, I know when it'll start, I know when it'll stop. With Corbin Carroll, I'll say the plate discipline is good. There are a lot of concerns about the overall power because StatCast doesn't know how hard he's hitting. Nothing does. So I would urge you to maybe refrain from the speculation that something's wrong with the shoulder in any actionable way. But I do think you have to put him in your lineup at least sometimes because you don't want to leave that production on the floor for a player who's just a random streamer.
This is a hard one, and I'm glad we're starting with it. I don't have a lot of Corbin Carroll this year. So fun story. Casey, Bubba, Brian, Entrican, and I were discussing last, I don't know, June, July, right before Corbin Carroll had those swings where he like grabbed his shoulder and like came out of the game and we thought his season was going to be over. So like literally that week, we were like both competitive in Tout Wars. I had pitching locked up and we were discussing Spencer Strider for Corbin Carroll straight up. And then we saw all of the swing drama and I was like, I can't do this until I know if Corbin Carroll's okay. And I never believed Corbin Carroll was okay. And that deal never happened. I think about that a lot with Corbin Carroll's slow start this year. It is the reason that I didn't draft Corbin Carroll anywhere this season. When I was first round early and I had options, like I was like, gonna go with Mookie Betts, gonna go with Kyle Tucker, gonna go with like basically literally anyone other than Corbin Carroll in that first round because of that shoulder. And now seeing this, I'm just like, oh my, like the red flags are pinging. If you took Corbin Carroll in the first round to be a 30-30 plus guy for you? Because let's be honest, he showed 30-30, 40-40 potential last season. You can't possibly replace that with anyone, so you have to ride it out. But there are some numbers here that are cause for concern, and the one that is really just screaming at me is the 19.3% hard hit rate. That is very low relative to what I expect from Corbin Carroll and from a first-round bat, and it does lead me to wonder if something is going on beyond just an approach issue or a BABIP issue. That's super low relative to where he was at this time last year. My apologies to all the Corbin Carroll owners in the world, but I do understand if you are panicking about Corbin Carroll.
Yeah, and so on one hand, the plate discipline is awesome. It's actually much better than it was last season. That's a good sign. His brain ain't broken. It's like he's seeing the ball just fine. He can't hit it. And while I am saying like, oh, don't, you know, don't completely speculate on injury. These numbers are extreme, right? Like 19% hard hit rate isn't low for Corbin Carroll. It's just low. It is super low. It is really, really hard to succeed in the major leagues with that kind of hard hit rate, unless you're, again, a Luis Arraez type, Jeff McNeil type player who is only trying to get the ball over the infield and not over the wall, right? Like, you can get away without hard hit rate to do that, but you can't do everything else you're trying to do. Like, the average exit velocity is way, way down. He's got a couple, like, his barrel rate was never that high. So that part doesn't concern me. But yeah, the hard hit rate, it's like, it's so far down. I do not hope anyone is ever injured, but if we find out that Corbin Carroll is injured, at least we have a clear explanation, because not many things can explain this kind of fall. And again, that doesn't mean you should drop him, or, you know, you can't trade him for anything, right? One thing you can do though is recalibrate your expectations, right? Like, you're still thinking about long-term, especially in Roto or head to head. You're thinking, what do I need to do to win this week or win this season? If you started out thinking, I think Corbin Carroll can be a 25 to 30 home run hitter, you need to recalibrate that right now. Because either we're looking at missed time or low home runs. Is it possible he gets to 20? Yeah, I think that's still in play. I think that if I was planning for the rest of the season, I would start at 15 and say, what does it look like if Corbin Carroll hits 15 home runs this year? How do I still win this league? How do I still stay competitive if Corbin Carroll hits half the home runs I thought he would? Now, that, again, that's not a death knell. That's not anything that says you can't compete. But you do absolutely, I think, need to recalibrate that part of the expectations, right? I think eventually the averages and everything, those can probably get better, right? I think those things are kind of hard to predict. But you got to start right now and say, I've got 15 home runs I thought I was going to get that I'm not going to get now. And that's where you start. And you don't get those back by cutting Corbin Carroll. Right? Like, that's the other thing. You don't get them back cutting Corbin Carroll. You get them back by looking for more power.
I think that's exactly right. And I love what you said about, like, just trying to recalibrate the category expectations. You're not cutting Corbin Carroll. I mean, he's striking out less than he ever has before. He's striking out 16.1% of the time. He's walking a ton at 12.7% of the time. He's going to steal bases. He is still projected by most projection systems for somewhere between 32 and 40 stolen bases, and he's running, right? When he gets on base, he's running and he's taking those walks. It's great. What you're seeing from Corbin Carroll is a power outage, and you probably wish you had taken him in like the fourth or fifth round rather than the first round, but you didn't. So you just have to adapt that somehow. But I do think the power is a concern, and I don't envy people in that position. To put this in perspective, I'm not doing a victory lap. I took Spencer Strider very early in the first round of a few leagues I care about a lot, because I thought that seemed like a really smart idea at the time, given the projected values and what I thought I was getting from Spencer Strider relative to the field, and that didn't work out. So sometimes things don't work out and you have to recalibrate.
I spent a boatload. I am in the 15 team auction, and I spent, you know, he was my most expensive pitcher by a fair margin, and I'm making do because I'm such a big Tarek Skubal fan that I also paid a bunch of money for him and it's working out. But I think the other thing to remember with Corbin Carroll is this guy, when, you know, I don't know if it's health, I don't know what it is, but when he's on, this is a guy capable of hitting, like, I mean, he hit 8 home runs last June, just in June. If he can fix whatever it is that's wrong, be it an injury, be it a mechanical problem, he's popping out in the infield a ton, whatever it is, he can make up for that lost ground really fast, which is, again, that's one of the reasons you can't cut him, because there's not a ton of players on the wire who you can just go and say, well, this guy might hit 8 home runs in a month. No, you already have that guy. You already have him. You just need him to be better.
I think that's right. And the last thing I'll say about Corbin Carroll, because I know we have a bunch of guys to get through and want to make sure we can talk about all of them, but the BABIP for him does indicate he's unlucky at the moment. His BABIP is 232, and that, you know, he's so fast that he can probably leg out a bunch of weakly hit ground balls in a way that other players can't. That BABIP is like fully 80 points lower than his career average. So that's going to improve. The question is just, are you going to get the home run?
Yeah. You know, speaking of other players, player we already teased a little bit earlier, Sarah, I'll let you start here. Let's talk a little bit about Alex Bregman.
Yeah, let's do it. I mean, Alex Bregman is the other guy that when I look at that hard hit percentage, and these are from Fangraphs, by the way, I'm not looking at Statcast at the moment, so the numbers might be slightly different because of where they pull them from, but his hard hit rate is at 19.8%. That is not very good. And Alex Bregman, you may remember this from when he was in the home run derby, but like, that is a dude who does not hit home runs because he mashes. That is a dude who hits home runs because of the way he pulls the ball. And he just kind of like dunks into that Crawford box area. Like that's his thing. That's like what he does. And this doesn't look like classic Alex Bregman. This is also not a player like Corbin Carroll, where you're talking about like, oh, he's 23 years old. He's just like figuring out some things and that. This is Alex Bregman's walk year. He is 30. So there are some real concerns if you have Alex Bregman at third base as to what you're going to get out of him for the rest of the season. I have concerns about that. Of the list that Scott provided me prior to the show on the rundown, the two that jumped out is like, yeah, I have real concerns here are actually Corbin Carroll and Alex Bregman. And I'm curious, Scott, if you have Bregman in any of your leagues, what are you planning on getting from him out of the rest of the season? Because honestly, I'm lowering my power expectations.
Yeah. So Bregman's interesting because the first thing I did, you know, I've done this enough times. I haven't done it so many times, but I've done it enough times where there's places I go immediately. Obviously, the plate discipline with Bregman is still great. It's always going to be great. It'll be great when he stinks, right? Because that's just the type of player he is. But and then I looked at two things in the batted ball data. Number one, his line drive rate is 9.9%. That's about half of what it should be. So that's probably what's killing the batting average a bit. But and I was ready to stop there. I was like, oh, look, his ground ball rate's about 10% too high and his line drive rate's about 10% too low. I wonder what's going to happen over time. That probably will fix itself. The problem, though, is that he's not pulling the ball, right? Like you said, Bregman's home run game is all about pulls right now. His pull rate was down a little bit last year, but as long as he's over 40%, Bregman, because of the way his home field plays, because of the way he hits the ball in general, it might bring his home runs like closer to 20 than 25, but as long as the pull rate's around 40%, I think that he can get by just fine. It's 33%. He's hitting a bunch of stuff up the middle. Now again, when we talk about, you know, there's two levels of problems you can see with a hitter. There's contact issues, and then there's like there's contact issues where you're not making contact, and then there's contact issues in that you're not making good contact, right? Going from no contact to good contact is a lot harder than going from bad contact to good contact, because at least you're talking about round bat on a round ball. You're talking about very micro adjustments in terms of like timing and in terms of where on the bat that the ball is hitting. He can fix those problems. But if the pull rate stays down at this 33 or 35%, that's a big problem. That's going to make him probably look more like a 15 to 17 home run hitter, maybe at best, right? He's got zero as of right now with this batted ball distribution, and it's not because he's unlucky. Like, the BABIP is really, really low, but his BABIP is always low because, again, he pulls a lot of fly balls, and any that don't make it over the fence land in gloves, right? Like, it's not that far for a corner outfielder to get to the foul line. So that's my biggest concern. The line drives and stuff, that'll bring the BABIP back, like the ground balls turning into line drives, that'll fix the BABIP problem. It's that pull rate. It's got to get better. Again, I don't like this is, you know, if you look at the rolling charts, this is about as low as it ever gets. And it's scary. It's got to turn around, or you instantly need to, I mean, I'm serious. You got to take 10 home runs off the top if that batted ball direction does get fixed.
I think that's right. I agree with you completely. And yeah, we kicked it off with the two guys I'm most worried about.
Yeah. Let's move. We're not going to go through this entire list. I do. I think maybe we can just do a little bit of back and forth here. I'll pick a player. You pick a player. But because I've picked the last two that we'll start with, Sarah, I'm going to let you pick. Tell us about a slumping player. And it doesn't necessarily have to be someone that you're worried about. We talked about two guys that we're very worried about. But just in general, what are you doing with this slumping player? And how are you adjusting expectations? Are you benching them? What are you doing with it?
So I'm just going to go with Corey Seager, who I know some people are probably like, oh, he doesn't look like himself. I think Corey Seager is totally fine. I look at things like the hard hit rate. I look at things like the BABIP. I look at things like the fact that he was coming off an injury, right? Like Corey Seager started the season faster than we thought he would. I think there's maybe an argument that he rushed himself to be ready to get ready for the very start of the season. And he's not quite like the difference with Corey Seager right now is not the same as the Bregman difference. Corey Seager went from an elite bat whose Statcast page was just riddled with deep red to, oh, he's kind of like not elite at the moment. I think that he will be elite and he will be elite soon. I think that he probably just rushed himself back from that oblique issue. And frankly, I have zero concerns about
it. Yeah. I'm glad you said that. Like, so actually, the one thing that I've been asked about a little with him is like, how does he get to 33 home runs? My answer would be the same way he did last season, because he had one home run at the end of April last year. He's got two now. He's ahead of schedule, right? Like this is not that scary of a change for Corey Seager. Statcast suggests he's also getting unlucky. I agree with you, Sarah. This just looks like a normal slump that will likely rectify itself in no time, because everything looks pretty much the same. The line drive rate is a little too low. It's kind of split between ground balls and fly balls. That'll come back over. That'll raise the batting average up a little bit. And the home runs, like, he's a little up and down with home runs. He only had five at the end of May, and he still hit 33, right? And he hit 33 the year before that. I completely agree. There's nothing really to worry about here for Corey Seager. Someone I am worried about, though, worried's the wrong. I want to talk a little bit about Will Benson. Will Benson, he's been leading off for the Reds. The thing about Will Benson is that he's slumping right now because that's just what this dude is going to do. He is he really struggles with contact, which is weird to say for a player that walks as much as he, but he doesn't swing at that stuff, right? His problem isn't that. When I say he has a contact problem, it's not like a Javi Baez contact problem, whose contact problem was that he wanted to make contact with everything and you can't, right? Will Benson's contact problem is he can't make contact with the stuff that he really probably should. And it leads to these high strikeout rates. And when guys have problems with strikeout rates like he does, which is close to 30%, you're just going to be a streaky hitter. Yes, he'll keep taking the walks, but Will Benson is a guy who's just always going to be this streaky on again, off again, sort of look. When he's great, you should roll with him. And when he's cold in a 12 team league, you might consider tossing him back unless you're in an OBP league, because it's the highs and lows are going to get really, really ugly. So it's not so much that I'm concerned about this slump from Will Benson. What I'm going to tell you is this is what he is. This is the type of player that Will Benson is. And until we see a significant change in the way he approaches, which I don't expect, this is just what he's going to be. That's okay. Just know that that's the train you're getting on, right? When you pick up Will Benson, you're getting power and speed, and you're sacrificing consistency. That's okay. That's something you can absolutely play with, but it's not something that it's like, hey, what's wrong with him? Nothing's wrong with him. This is what he is. This is how he
plays. Totally with you on Will Benson. The thing that jumps off the page for me, you know, last season, the strikeout rate was high at 31.3%. It was also about 31% with Cleveland in 2022 in a very limited sample size. This season, it's 39.2%. And like, you love the 10.8% walk rate because that's great. It means he's getting on base. He's going to steal some bags and score some runs and whatnot. But like, cannot have a leadoff hitter that strikes out 39.2% of the time. That is Patrick Wisdom territory. That is like your borderline not going to be able to keep the job territory. So I'm totally with you on Will Benson. I think he's a streaky guy. He's going to be a streaky guy. When the streak is good, put him in your lineup and be ready to cut bait when it's.
Yeah. It's It's just the nature of the player, and I'm not going to talk about him much, but that's why I do think Jonathan India can win that leadoff job back. I don't think you should add him in 12 teamers right now, but Jonathan India has the plate skills and contact ability that you expect for a leadoff guy. Will Benson's a leadoff guy because they need somebody to do it, and he was hot, and he won't be forever. So, Sarah, I don't know if you have one or two more players you want to call out before we head to our next break and then talk about players doing well, which is a lot more fun.
I mean, I just want to retweet what you said about Jonathan India. I mean, I'm looking at their lines right now. Will Benson walks 10.8% of the time, strikes out 39.2% of the time, and has an on-base percentage of 284. That is not rosterable in an on-base percentage league. Jonathan India walks 14.3% of the time, strikes out 20.4% of the time, and has an on-base percentage of 347. Yeah, Will Benson has more power overall, but Jonathan India is the guy that I would much rather have on my team. I just want to have, let's talk about one more of these guys. And this is an interesting one for me just because of the park itself. Spencer Torkelson is someone I believe in. I've rostered him in a bunch of places. I have him in Glarf, which is a league where I loved my draft. I'm doing pretty well, and I really want him to do the things I want Spencer Torkelson to do. But one of the factors we have not yet talked about, which can be structural, and you should use it to inform your decisions, is the park itself. Detroit is a terrible place to hit. It's an objectively awful place to hit. It's one of the reasons that, like, Isak Paredes was not on anyone's radar before he went to Tampa. It's one of the reasons that Nick Castellanos was kind of like, yeah, it's Nick Castellanos. He's just like a guy who like hits some doubles sometimes before he went to the Cubs and then the Reds and now the Phillies. We're going to talk about him in a bit, I'm sure, too. But like, I'm curious what you think about Spencer Torkelson.
Yeah, it's a terrible start for him. Detroit, Comerica Park's a weird place to hit because it's really good if you want to hit doubles and triples. It's really bad if you want to hit home runs. It's big. It's huge. The batter's eye is great. There's huge power alleys, but not, again, not for home runs, for doubles and things like that. I think I'm a little bit more concerned with Torque than I was last season because he's not hitting the ball hard either. That's down. I'm not sure what's wrong. What I will say, which is something I said about him last year as well, it's not a contact problem. It's a quality of contact problem. Quality of contact can be fixed. Torque was terrible to start the season last year as well. He was terrible in his MLB debut, and it's all quality of contact issues. It's all stuff that, again, can be fixed. He's hitting the ball in the air a ton. He's pulling the ball a ton. He's just not doing it. You can just tell he's very, very close, which is weird because the Statcast page is all blue, blah, blah, blah. He's very close because he's doing a lot of the things we want him to do. He's just not doing it good enough, which is a weird thing to say about what was possibly the best college prospect we've seen in a decade. But that's the way it's going for Torque. So I think you have to hold with him, but he is someone that I think you should be willing to bench in 12 team leagues. The Tigers were willing to bench him today. I mean, granted it's a Sunday. I want to do like a quick lightning round of just a few more names of guys not doing well and just your quick thoughts on can that go better. I want to start with Nico Hoerner. Sarah, you follow the Cubs very closely. Is this guy going to steal bases? Are the Cubs going to steal bases at all?
I'm going to have to take the L on this one. I don't think the Cubs are going to steal bases. And I'm frankly stunned by this because everything that was said at Cubs convention, everything I saw last season led me to believe that the Cubs were going to steal bases. Nico talked about wanting to run more. I was like, oh yeah, 50 bases. Like, let's go. I don't think he is. So Pitcher List has some leagues that are like wacky leagues that you can do with people in the Discord and stuff like that. And I'm in one called Grand Theft where you get to like steal a player. I moved Nico Hoerner off my protected. I love him. I think he's a 300 batting average bat. I don't think he's going to steal the bags. And that breaks me a little bit because I want him to, but he is batting average and steals and runs. And if you're not getting one of those things, he's now a two category player. And that basically makes him Luis Arraez.
Yeah. That's my concern as well, that it's Luis Arraez, but like a little less than that because
a little more. The Cubs are better than the Marlins.
Yeah, but Luis Arraez is going to hit like 330.
Right.
but right. I agree with the point.
Poor man's Luis Arraez.
Yeah. I think that it could turn into some very empty batting average. I think in points leagues, the hit won't be that hard because he'll still just hit a bunch of singles and a couple of doubles. But no, the Cubs have 8 stolen bases.
They're not running. No, yeah. It appears to be a team philosophy.
They've been caught 7 times. Like, they're just bad at it.
it appears to be a team philosophy. And I actually was, we were just talking about this with Jason Collette on Fantasy Feud recently. One of the things that I noticed with the Cubs running last year was that they were running on particular batteries. They were running on particular pitcher catcher combos where the catcher had a high enough pop time and the pitcher was slow enough to the plate that they were just taking advantage. Most of those battery combinations, according to Jason, who I have no reason to doubt any of his information, they don't exist anymore. So like Jacob Stallings used to be a starting catcher who got a bunch of starts and now he does not, right? Like Austin Hedges is a guy that the Cubs ran on a bunch with some Dodgers pitchers, and that doesn't seem to be an opportunity that they're going to have in the near future either. It looks like the thing they were exploiting with their slightly slower dudes who were stealing bases doesn't exist anymore because teams have tightened that up. That doesn't mean they'll never run, but their current philosophy, and this was Mike Napoli talked about this pregame a couple of days ago, prior to one of the Red Sox games, they're trying to exploit being good base runners, not necessarily stealing bases. And so I apologize to anyone who thought the Cubs were going to steal bags. I thought they were too. I don't think they are anymore.
Yeah, and it's worth noting that there's not a ton of teams in their division this year that are giving up a ton of stolen bases. The Phillies do, right? So the Phillies have given up 29. There's a couple teams towards the top, the Mets, the Nationals, the Phillies, the Rays, and as always, the White Sox. They give up lots of stolen bases, but the Cubs haven't played those guys that much.
They're about to play the Mets. So it'll be really interesting to see if they run against the Mets.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I think that's going to be like, that's going to be a real tell. Like if Nico has any chance of getting to 20, it's because he gets like one, at least one or two against the Mets and they still take advantage. So very last thing we'll do before the break, because I just want to squeeze it in. I'm going to read you a list of players. I want you to tell me which ones you are cutting or are close to cutting in a 12 team. I'll even
standard
say like
categories.
Four. Yeah. Yep. Here are the names: Nolan Jones, Randy Arozarena. I'll skip Christopher Morel. O'Neill Cruz, Gleyber Torres, Nick Castellanos, Colton Cowser, and Wyatt Lang.
The guys that I'm worried enough about to potentially cut there are Nolan Jones, who I don't have a bunch of anyway, just because he was never somebody I drafted and was not super in on. Colton Cowser, I worry about playing time more than anything, but he's been really good and seems to be earning playing time. So like, you're not cutting a guy who's got a WRC plus of 199 and six home runs and three stolen bases with his time in the show. I think it's possible that you have better options than Nick Castellanos. And he's the one that like, oh God, this pains me so much because I love Nick. I love Nick Castellanos. I'm always going to think of him as Nick the Stick at Wrigley Field. But that was a hitting profile that was never going to age well. And it looks a lot like what we saw from Javier Baez a couple of years ago. And I just worry that we're seeing the end of what Nick Castellanos can do with his bat. Ellen Adair was recently on the RotoWire podcast. And if you've not checked out Ellen's show, Take Me Into the Ball Game on the Pitcherless Network, you absolutely should. It's incredible. But Ellen was also lamenting the fact that Nick Castellanos at the plate right now looks like a man who is mystified that he can no longer catch up to the slider off the plate that he used to be able to catch up. And it's going to be really interesting to see if he can adapt to that and stop swinging at that pitch, or if he goes the route of Javier's. And that's one where in a 12 team league, I might cut.
Yeah, no, I think I defend Nick a lot as well. I'm a fan of his from his Detroit days. The one thing I can say in his defense is that for the last few years, really since leaving Chicago, he's been incredibly streaky, incredibly up and down, but that's tied to what you just talk about. It's tied to the fact that he is really aggressive, which is weird because he doesn't always strike out very much, especially early in his career, but he's really aggressive because he wants to put his bat on everything. And that gets really hard to do as you get older. I think that we're going to see lower lows. I think he's still going to be streaky. He's still going to have good, he's still going to have good streaks, but the lows are going to start getting too low to keep rostering through those periods. I do want to bring up Gleyber Torres has been cut in a bunch of leagues, at least based on my inboxes and DMs. Stop doing that. Don't cut him. No. He's been cut. Pick him up. He's going to be fine. Like, there's nothing. The reason we've not talked about Gleyber Torres is because there's not really that much to say. He's slumping.
Can I actually, you mentioned Christopher Morel here, and I feel like I have to shout out my dude.
Yeah, let's do it.
Christopher Morel is 24 years old and a light tower power talent. He hits the ball so hard, it is utterly incredible and a sight to be reckoned with. The one thing that people have been able to complain about with Christopher Morel for his first two seasons, which, by the way, were his 22 and 23-year-old seasons in the major leagues, he came up from double-A people and, like, had no knowledge of triple-A pitching or anything else. He just, like, came up and, like, set the Cubs on base percentage record to start his career, is his strikeout rate, which has been in the high 20s, low 30s for most of the time he's been in the league. Christopher Morel this season is striking out, like, 21% of the time. What we are seeing from Christopher Morel with his struggles right now are, one, a very low BABIP that is going to normalize at some point in time, and two, a guy who figured out how to cut his strikeout rate 9% year over year. You want Christopher Morel to go through this growing pain, because on the flip side is a guy who's going to hit 40 home runs and strike out like 19% of the time, and it's going to be incredible. Do not cut Christopher Morel.
I'm actually going to second you on that, even though I've been hard on him in the past. So Christopher Morel is an extremely inconsistent decision maker. Our pitcherless metrics show that he goes from like best in the league to worst in the league over a period of like 2 weeks. That's really indicative of a young player. That a player who maybe didn't have a lot of time in the high minors. That's a very normal thing. Pitchers find new little holes. It takes him a while to close them up. I wanted two things to happen this year. I wanted the slumps to not quite be so painful. I wanted them to end a little sooner. Now, he's been in a slump for a little while. He seems to be turning it around over his last six games or so. He's got a couple doubles. He's put some balls in play after, you know, he had a really, really ugly stretch where he only had one hit. The difference, though, is that the slumps that looked like this last year came with 40% strikeout rates. This year, since his last home run, so since April 10th, where he's been objectively bad, WRC plus, like really, really bad, it's still a 12.9% walk rate and a 25.8% strikeout rate. That's a slump I can get behind. Every player slumps. And this one is particularly painful, yes. But the fact that he can play third base, which is a really difficult position to fill, and also the fact that the plate discipline is much, much better than it was. That is a sign of growth. Going from a guy who didn't strike out, like who struck out when he was good and when he was bad, to a guy who now isn't even striking out that much when he's bad. That's a huge change. It's massive. You should be very, very happy that this is what the slump looks like and not what they looked like a year or two.
Yeah. The last thing I retweet all of that. And also, like, when I asked Cubs prospect people about Christopher Morel when he first got called up, they were like, Javi Baez light. I'm going to tweak that because I think he's Javi Baez plus. Javi Baez never put up walk rates, the likes of which Christopher Morel is putting up. And Javi Baez never learned how to lay off those pitches outside of the zone the way that Christopher Morel is. Christopher Morel is showing the type of growth that we all wished Javi would have shown when he was in those hot years. And I think that means he's going to be a much better player long-term. Someone just offered me a trade in a new league for Christopher Morel that I couldn't even read. I was like, I have a $6 Christopher Morel and there's no way that you are getting that away from me in the next five seasons. So try again.
All right. That was a very long stretch without a break. We're going to take a short break. We're going to come back. We're going to fly through players who are doing well. We're just so excited to talk about baseball right now. Sarah, you're awesome. Excited to talk to you a little bit more right after this. And we are back. Thanks for hanging with us, folks. I know it's been a long show, but it's been a good one, darn it. Even if you don't like it, I'm having a heck of a time. So thank you, Sarah, for being here with me to talk about baseball. My wife doesn't want to talk with me about baseball at 11:39 p.m. Eastern time, but you do. So somebody has to be subjected to this. I'm glad it's you today. So we've talked about the bad, right? We talked about players who are struggling. Let's talk about some players who are doing good. Right. We're going to try to go through these a little bit faster, but I will let you lead with yet another Cub, because if I've got a Cubs person on, I'm going to talk about Cubs. Someone who I think could be helping people's outfields right now, if you're dealing with some injuries or especially maybe in an OBP league. Sarah, talk to me about Mike Tauchman.
I love Mike Tauchman. I'm such a fan. So first of all, y'all know if your team has won a World Series in your lifetime, like when you have a team that is good, you have to have those role players. Like, it's not just the best guys who do things. Like, there's some guy who's your fourth outfielder or your utility guy or like a bullpen arm that is just a stud. And Mike Tauchman is that guy for the Chicago Cubs. I wrote a piece about Mike Tauchman last year, maybe about 8 months ago, looking at the fact that I always thought it was quirky that his on-base percentage was higher than his slugging. And I knew that that was a thing that was not common in Major League Baseball, and it's not. It turned out that at the time I wrote that piece, there were like 13 guys who had that particular metric, and most of them are dudes that you don't want to roster in fantasy. But for Mike Tauchman at the moment, you do. whether you're in an OBP league or not, because he's hitting second for the Chicago Cubs, and he's going to be in the lineup every single day as long as Cody Bellinger and Seiya Suzuki are out, because the Cubs need that stabilizing bat in their lineup. He's a doubles machine. He's hit a handful of home runs too, don't get me wrong, but you're not getting him for power. You're getting him because he hits second in the lineup for a very good offensive team. He gets on base at like a 370 clip, and you're getting extra bases, not necessarily just empty singles, which it makes him kind of more like a Mark Grace type than a Luis Arias type, and I'm here for it.
Yeah, Mike Tauchman, again, it's far too early, and again, especially in like 12-team leagues, redraft leagues, don't ask me, is Mike Tauchman better than some dude rest of season? Because I'm not really that, you know, I have an appreciation for Mike Tauchman, but you're not making a Mike Tauchman decision for rest of season. You're making a Mike Tauchman decision for as long as he keeps hitting second, right? And as long as he keeps hitting second, especially in OBP leagues, he is absolutely worth rostering. He's hot, like not just because he's hot right now. He actually hit a home run today. He's not just hot. He's in a great position. Again, he's hitting second. You know how many times? Like, there's only 30 guys in the league on any given day at most who hit second for a day. Tauchman's going to keep doing it. There are fewer guys who get to do that. And there's even fewer who are actually relevant in fantasy. Like, whoever it is that, you know, when Zach Gieloff's hurt, whoever is hitting second for the Oakland A's, I don't care. Sorry, all 12 A's fans who will continue to be alienated by a weird ownership decision that has continued to just go poorly. But with Tauchman, it's second for a good team and a guy with consistent skills. This is not someone who's just like all of a sudden going to fall off the face of the earth and not hit at all. That has happened to him in the past, but since he's been a Cub, he's been an above average hitter pretty much all the time, right? I talk about rolling charts, everyone's up and down. Tauchman lows don't go that low. The highs cap out a little bit when you're talking about pure power and speed. He doesn't have a ton of either of those, but this guy's going to contribute for you while he's hitting second. Pick him up while he's doing that. Leave him in. The Cubs can't sit him. We were talking before the show. They don't have enough players to sit Mike Tauchman right now. He's got to stay in. Look, when Seiya Suzuki come back and Cody Bellinger come back, maybe in a month or two, look, then there's some cut decisions about Mike Tauchman. If he gets really, you know, if he gets into a really bad slump, you might have some cut decisions about Mike Tauchman. But get it while the getting's good. Get it while the getting's free. And don't worry about it, right? Because again, you're not thinking about Mike Tauchman rest of season. You're talking about what he can do for you right now. And that's quite a bit.
Yes. And the injuries to Seiya and Cody Bellinger are not 10-day injuries. You're not picking up Mike Tauchman for 2 weeks. Seiya Suzuki has an oblique injury that was described as moderate. He's been on the injured list for, I think, a week and a half now, but that's a 4 to 6 week injury, right? Like, you're talking a mid-June return for Seiya Suzuki. Cody Bellinger has fractured ribs. That's a 4 to 6 week injury. Like, that outfield spot is open for a month. So you might as well get a number two hitter for a month.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we're both high on Mike Tauchman. I'm going to talk a little bit about Eloy Jimenez. So yeah, Eloy, I am so torn because on one hand, you think we'd all be really excited that Eloy Jimenez is hitting well right now, because this is a big, big dude who was a big, big time prospect. You know, 80, I mean, we're talking like 80 grade power from a lot of folks. He is, you know, he's walking, which is weird for him. He doesn't usually walk. The White Sox just don't walk. They don't like walking. They only try to hit, much to their detriment, I think. But you know, here's the thing with Eloy. I love that he's hot right now. There's nothing about it that's like a fraud, right? Eloy is absolutely capable of this. Eloy absolutely should be scooped up in whatever leagues you have. But don't think about Eloy Jimenez rest of season, just like Mike Tauchman, right? Eloy is on a terrible team. Yeah, he'll keep hitting cleanup for them, but you need to. Eloy has two types of risk. I tend to avoid players who have two types of risk at the same time. Eloy Jimenez has performance risk and he has injury risk. Eloy has not been a consistent hitter when healthy, right? This isn't the type of thing where, well, when he's healthy, he's great, but he gets hurt a lot. Actually, Eloy has two problems: that he can be very inconsistent when healthy, and also he's not healthy much, right? It's sort of what Byron Buxton has turned into. There was a while when Byron Buxton was the guy who, when healthy, goes off, right? And just that doesn't happen very often. But current state Byron Buxton, who doesn't run anymore, is actually very, very similar to Eloy in that there's a lot of upside when healthy, but don't get too married to it because that production really comes and goes. And it's the ceiling is not at all what we hoped it would be, at least at this stage of his career. He's only 27 years old. He'll turn 28, I think, around the end, actually probably a little after the end of the season. But like, he's someone, Eloy Jimenez, in a 12-team league at least, is a streamer, right? A good one, a good streamer with a little more upside than other streamers in terms of like 99th percentile outcome. But just remember, injuries and inconsistency both are very, very real threats. So it's hard to get overly excited for long term. But for short term, much like Mike Tuchman, yeah, absolutely. Do it. Like, there's nothing that should stop you. You've probably got an open outfield spot. Just go for it. Just remember that he runs into issues where he does not, you know, he just doesn't hit the ball with great quality. And also, then he all of a sudden injures something because he's a giant, giant man. And it's hard to stay healthy when you're there.
Yeah, I was going to say the biggest risk with Eloy is that he's going to get hurt. Eloy came up through the Cubs system and they traded him to the White Sox along with Dylan Cease for Jose Quintana, which that was a bad day. I have referred to Eloy as the natural on more than one occasion. He really has that type of hit tool. I wish the White Sox would have figured out years ago that they should stop playing him in the field and just let him hit, because I think he would be injured far less frequently. And I think we would just watch him hit bombs all the time. He does have a tendency to get hurt. So when he gets hurt, be willing to drop him. But until then, you could do a lot worse than Eloy. A guy who we were drafting like second, third round a couple of years ago. And he's like on your waiver wire. Go pick him up.
Yeah. I will say it is nice that he's not in the field right now. Even though like the White Sox don't really have a lot of better fielders, I'm glad that he's not, because it reduces the injury risk to an extent, not entirely, because again, he's still very big and hitting is a twisting sort of thing. That's a lot of body to twist. Like, I'm not a doctor, but I'll tell you, like, those guys can get hurt.
Scott, you remember that Eloy got hurt in like a post game, like, fracas, right? Like, there was there was literally like, I think somebody got hit with a pitcher. So I don't know. There was a fight. The White Sox had gotten a fight. And in this like post of the fight, somebody's like, I think Eloy is limping away. And yeah, he spent time on the injured list for that. It was literally just like he existed and he got hurt.
It's rough. I'm going to sneak in a Tiger to talk about. He's doing good. I want to talk very briefly about Mark Canna, because again, I want to talk about a guy that you don't care about for rest of season. You care about for right now. Mark Canna, who it's sort of like in a better position than Tuchman in that Canna is going to keep hitting in the middle of the order like all year. And he should be reasonably healthy, about 140 games. Look, he's only going to hit, he's got 5 home runs right now, which is far more than I thought he'd hit in any single month. He's got maybe up to 15 to 18 home run power with really good ratios, particularly OBP. He's especially hot right now. Eventually he'll just kind of be sort of lame. But that's okay, because Mark Canna hits in the middle of the lineup. He's on a team that really could use his left-handed bat there. He's right-handed. They really want him against lefties. He's always going to be in the middle of the lineup against lefties, even when he's bad, right? At some point when he's bad, he might slide down the lineup a little bit. But honestly, he's going to probably most of the time be hitting second, third, fourth, and slapping the ball around, hitting doubles, getting more RBI than a player with his level of power probably should, because he's going to be hitting in the middle of a lineup. The Tigers offense isn't that bad all the time. They are right now, but not all the time. So again, an outfielder who that's the funny thing with some of these hot streak guys, they're not doing anything different. This is just the good version of what they can do. This is like every player has ups and downs, and these guys, when they're up, it is real in the sense that they can do this for a month or two, right? Mark Canna could probably even do this for half a season, probably not a whole season, but at least half a season. And that's relevant even in 12 team leagues, even for a guy who probably can't hit 20 home runs, and that's okay. Again, you should have an outfield spot that you can sort of rotate in and out. Sarah, are there any more hot players you want to talk about before we get to some of the specific ones I have to talk about?
There are, but I want to say a couple of words about Mark Canna first, because one, the on-base percentage right now is 407. The career is 351. Both of those are great, regardless of whether you're in an OBP league or not, just because it means he's getting on base, which is an opportunity for RBIs, an opportunity for runs, all those types of things. But the thing I love about Mark Canha that I just want to emphasize here, he is first base eligible in most leagues because of where he played last season. And first base is a problem right now. Like, if you have Jose Abreu or Paul Goldschmidt, you're like, ugh, I don't know what I'm doing right now. Mark Canha is doing great. It's not your corner infielder spot. You could do a lot worse than Mark Canha and what he's doing at the moment. Yes, you're not getting a ton of power from it, but you are getting a guy who gets on base all of the time. And even when that 407 regresses back to his 351 average, like, you'll be fine. So love the Mark Canha suggestion. And I think I just picked him up in, I don't remember which league. I have too many leagues, Scott.
Yeah. And again, you might be suffering because you've got a struggling Paul Goldschmidt. You've got an Anthony Rizzo who had a really good day today, but has been struggling recently. Or maybe you've got Spencer Torkelson and he's not doing well, right? Like, that's a first baseman you can absolutely plug and play until those other guys figure it out. Because again, you're not worried about Mark Canha for the rest of the season. You're worried about him until your original first baseman figures things out or gets healthy. So that's a big one. So yeah, Sarah, who else have you got?
So the first guy I want to talk about here, and I just put a fab bid in on him and I'm praying I got him. Brendan Doyle is really good. He looks really good right now. He's slashing 326, 373, 516. He plays in Coors. He is a center fielder who is a plus center fielder. So he's not going to lose his job anytime soon. He strikes out a lot. He strikes out 29.4% of the time. He doesn't walk very much, but he plays in Coors. So he hits a lot. And I'm kind of intrigued by Brendan Doyle. I just put some bids on him and I'm curious what you think about him.
Brendan Doyle's weird.
It's weird.
He's weird. He actually he's actually like right now hitting as well on the road as he is at home. He's just hitting everywhere. Brendan Doyle, I'm very curious to see how this road trip goes. But I think what you can expect is a guy who's just going to be really streaky, right? We saw him 10 home runs, 22 stolen bases last year with, objectively terrible offensive numbers in terms of like the ratios. He was not good last year in 431 at bats. With a 43 WRC plus. Most guys with a 43 WRC plus don't get to start 126 games, but Brendan Doyle did because the Rockies are awful. And if you need power and speed, he's going to keep playing. He should hit better than he did last season. I don't think that you're going to get like all-star numbers from him, especially on the road. I think that the swing and miss is really going to catch up with him there because of that reverse Coors effect. Like, it helps when you're in Coors, and Coors hurts you when you leave because you're not used to balls moving that far. And it's tough. But again, there's just not that many players who are just going to be available who have real like 15 home run, 20 to 25 stolen base upside, right? Like they just don't come around that often. Brendan Doyle is one of those guys. And if he can be even just like regular bad, like over the course of whole season, in terms of like batting average, like if he can hit like 240, right? The OBP will stink, but if he can even just hit 240, the rest of it will be good enough that I think that he is absolutely a back end guy, even in 12 team leagues for categories in Roto because of the power speed combo. Again, even if the rest of the stats like aren't great, they should be good enough that they don't hurt you the same way they did last season.
I agree with that. And the last guy I think we have to talk about on this list, Willier Abreu for the Red Sox. I am a fan, and I'm a fan for two reasons. I talked about structural stuff earlier, like what is going on with the lineup, what is going on with the team. Willier Abreu has a job, and he has a job for the foreseeable future as long as he doesn't do something to mess it up. And the bat is kind of interesting. He's slashing 309, 385, 500. Now, admittedly, he's built that off a 396 BABIP. But the crazy thing about this is that last season he had a 431 BABIP. All of this is in incredibly small sample sizes. He had 85 plate appearances last season, 78 this season. I don't think that that's going to persist. But the bat looks good. The power looks real. Fenway is an excellent place to hit. And I think Willier Abreu is going to play.
Absolutely. I think if Willier Abreu stays in the lineup the whole season, I think this is, I'm going to go with like 20-ish home runs and probably 10 stolen bases too. He's already got four. He might even get close to 15 based on how aggressive he's been so far. I don't expect the OBP. This guy in 50 games so far in his major league career has a 387 OBP. He had amazing OBPs in the minors as well. I think the walks will keep coming. I think the OBP will just go down to being regular good, like 350-ish, instead of this 380 nonsense that he's got. But no, I think I think there's a, again, 20 home runs, 10 stolen bases. I mean, that's nothing to scoff at. That's some real production in the middle of the Red Sox lineup. You could also be looking at, like, you know, 75 RBI or so, depending on exactly how much he plays and what his slumps look like. For players of, you know, with players with this little experience in the major leagues, my thing is always, I want to see their first slump. I want to see how long it goes. I want to see how bad it gets, right? How quickly do they turn it around? We haven't seen that yet for Willie Abreu. So that's like the one thing that stops me from saying, like, he's definitely 20 home runs, 10 stolen bases. But I think that's definitely a very plot. Like, there's probably even more upside there if you really want. You want to start extrapolating or whatever. But I think that's a realistic outcome you could see for Willie Abreu if he plays the whole season.
I agree with that. And I just want to, fun with small sample sizes for a second, this number will not survive. But his current career MLB BABIP is 414.
It's wild. And it's not even because he has like a million line drives. He only has 16% line drives. I've never seen someone with a 16% line drive rate have that kind of BABIP. It is obscene.
I love it.
I don't even know how you do that. StatCast is not a big fan. This season, last year, it actually liked him a lot. Like last year, he was actually a little unlucky on the power side. This year, it's not so good, but we'll see how that all balances out. So those are some guys that are doing well right now. There's one player I think we have to talk about who's doing well. We don't have to talk long, but Jordan Westberg. Jordan Westberg has been an absolute breakout. There's a lot of guys who could have been breakout stars as of this moment for the Orioles. Jordan Westberg is probably the most unlikely of those that have actually turned out to be a sort of a breakout star. Sarah, what are your thoughts on Jordan Westberg and what this could look like for the rest?
I think I was 6 months too early on Jordan Westberg because I was one of the people who spent like the last of my big fab budget on Jordan Westberg at the end of last season. And I got kind of burned about it. And you probably got burned by it too, because if you spent $100+ in fab to put Jordan Westberg on your team last season, what you saw was a guy who didn't play every day, who was kind of platooned and who put up some mediocre numbers for a really good team. And you were probably out this draft season. I know I was. That was incorrect, because what Jordan Westberg is doing with consistent playing time is a 304, 360, 543 slash line. The ISO is obscene. It's a 239 ISO. He's got a WRC plus of 162. He's already got 5 home runs and he steals bases. He's got 4 of them. The K rate is good. It's better than last year. It's 18.8%. He doesn't really walk enough, but I'm a big Jordan Westberg fan and I'm kind of kicking myself for being in on a guy and then out on him, mainly because of playing time decisions that were out of his control.
Yeah. And actually that was my concern coming into this season with Jordan Westberg, is I didn't see how he'd play. I knew the Orioles were willing to bring up guys who are raking in the minors and sit them. I mean, look at Heston Kjerstad right now. Like they just don't play him. It's the weirdest thing. I don't know why they do it. They were willing to play Jackson Holliday for so long when he was not playing well. But again, Kjerstad's an outfielder. They've got a lot of outfielders, so I'm not sure why he's up, but he is, I guess. I mean, Jordan Westberg is not getting lucky, right? Like, let's be very clear. Everything he's doing, like, StatCast supports everything he's doing. And what that means is, again, it's not luck. This dude is actually smoking the ball all over the field. There's only one red flag that I see with Jordan Westberg, and it's that he doesn't make contact very well right now. So last season, he was quite good at like making contact, especially like in the zone. Right now, his zone contact rate is under 80%. Like, to me, that's, again, that's like a big red line I don't love to cross. When you miss, 20% of the time on the swings you make in the zone, that's potentially problematic. And his swinging strike rate is really high, So actually I should say some zone contact measurers have him closer to 80% than under, but either way, a 15.9% swinging strike rate is extremely unusual for a guy with a 18.8% strikeout rate. So like usually the back of the napkin math is like, what's a guy's, you know, projected strikeout rate? You take the swinging strike rate, you double it, and then maybe drop it by one or two, right? Like that's generally what you see. This dude's swinging strike rate is almost as high as his strikeout rate. That's really weird, right? Like I'm not saying that means he's going to start striking out more. He didn't strike out that much in the minor leagues. He didn't strike out that much last season, but that's a really, really bizarre thing that's happening that has my eyebrow raised. Again, it doesn't mean that he's not hitting the ball hard. Doesn't mean that he's getting lucky. It means that something very weird is going in the background. And I'll tell you that that specific number combination, right? Something has to give. Either the strikeout rate has got to go up a lot, or the swinging strike rate needs to come down, because you can't have a 15 something percent swinging strike rate and an 18 something percent strikeout rate. It just does. You can't do that. The math doesn't work. It makes baseball brains explode to like see those two numbers next to each other and be like, how does he just stop swinging after like one strike? Like what happened? Like what is happening? Cause he doesn't walk that much either. It's not like he starts walking. He doesn't walk. Like, what's happening?
It's small sample size magic, Scott. It's going to be figured out by the All-Star break. We can do the show again at the All-Star break, and I'm sure it'll be figured out.
Yeah, so again, something has to give. I'm not saying it's going to be the strikeout rate going to just spike. But, like,
I agree.
It's just worth calling out. That's a really, really weird thing that's happening. Obviously, the other potential pressure is that the Orioles have a ton of guys in their system, including a guy like Connor Norby, but there's no way Jordan Westbrook gets sat. I did famously my AMA is not that famous, but I did say that I am fairly risk averse. And I think if you could trade Jordan Westbrook for Isak Paredes, I think that'd be a good move. Now, most of you aren't going to do that. That's okay. Right. It's two very weird guys being traded for each other, but I'd say there is no risk to Isak Paredes right now if he slumps not playing, right? Again, maybe Junior Caminero, whatever, but I'm hedging on that a little bit now. Like I said it, I felt confident. I'm hedging a little bit more now, just because the more I dig on Jordan Westbrook, there's just like not warts to find except for that weird swinging strike rate. But Jordan Westbrook, I think a breakout season for him definitely looks like 23-ish. I mean, we could see like a 23 home run, 15 stolen base season here. I think that eventually the batting average comes down a bit. I don't think he's a 300 guy, but 270, sure. 280, why not? Right. I think he could be a very, very good player. But again, I don't want people to think that like there's a level above that here. Like this is not a 30 home run guy. This is not a 20 stolen base guy. That's not the type of player this is. This is what he looks like when he's hot, which is awesome, but that still probably suggests a 23, maybe in the right year, 25 home runs, probably something more like 23, 22. But you know, Sarah, I don't know if you have different thoughts on what he could look like over a full season, but I just don't want people to get too overboard just because the StatCast page is all red.
No, I think that's all right. And I also think that, I mean, the thing that scared me off of Jordan Westbrook this draft season was the playing time issue that we already talked about above. And I just, that could come back, right? Like one of the things with all of these Orioles guys is the team is so deep that the second one of these guys starts to slump, they can be replaced by somebody else. You've got Jackson Holliday is already back in the minors. Heston Kjerstad is sitting on the bench for hashtag reasons. You've got Colton Cowser has earned a spot right now, but for how long? You've got Mayo, who's sitting in the minors. The one concern about getting to those like baseline numbers of 25 and 15 is that at some point Jordan Westbrook slumps and doesn't. Until he slumps, he's got a job.
It takes two bad weeks right now in Baltimore to lose a job. Like unless you're Gunnar Henderson or Adley Rutschman, you got two bad weeks, you could start losing playing time. It's that intense. We've been going for quite a while. I'm going to give you back your life. It's even late in Central Time at this point, but I do want to, because this news came out, what, like an hour before we started recording or so, let's quickly talk about Joey Loperfido. He's called up. I'm a little worried because this dude has a high strikeout rate in AAA that rarely translate well to the major league, but he is hitting the absolute crap out of the ball. Sarah, in a 12 team league, do you have to add Joey Loperfido? And even if you don't, you know, tell me what you think about this guy coming up who presumably should play regularly because Jose Abreu certainly shouldn't.
The question about whether you're adding him or not in 12 teamers to me is whether you have a need at corner infielder or first base. There are teams that do, right? Like if you, like me, lost Cody Bellinger and he was your starting first baseman on teams, then you might need a starting first baseman and you don't have someone on the waiver wire you can go get. It's a weirdly out position. Like it's a hard thing to find right now. the hard hit numbers are scary good. I actually am so excited about this because this was my first year in the First Pitch Arizona Rookie League draft, and I was terrified of this draft. It's a bunch of people who are all the prospect writers that I go to listen, like I go to for advice, including my Fantasy Feud co-host, Shelley Verstrate, who is incredible and amazing at all things dynasty and prospect. And I was just like, how am I supposed to, Eric Cross and Chris Clegg and the Welsh and Shelley. And I'm like, how am I supposed to compete against any of these people in a rookie league draft? And I just started pouring over depth charts and looking for people who might have opportunities for a job. My second to last pick was Joey Loperfield. And I love him. And I just, the hard hit rate was there. Jose Abreu was not very good. I just saw a playing time opportunity and I decided to snag it. Yeah, the strikeout rate is problematic, but he has increased his max exit velocity to over 113 miles per hour. He has a ton of home runs right now in AAA. He's going to get a long look at Houston, and he crushed spring training. So it's not like this is the first time they are seeing him. They saw him in spring training and they have decided now is the time. I think, you know, this Astros team needs an offensive jolt. They just came back from Mexico City and Jose Abreu was not it. I think that Joey's going to get a chance. And if you need a corner infielder or a first baseman because you're dealing with Paul Goldschmidt's not doing very well, or Jose Abreu's not doing very well, or Jamer Candelario's not doing very well, or Noel V. Marte is suspended, or like all of the players who went in those early drafts that are sitting on our rosters that were like, oh my God, how am I going to play at corner? Give him a chance. See how it goes. I do think it's like a 12-team cutoff, though. I think this is like a 15-team, 12-team mono league play. I don't think this is like a 10-team.
No, I completely agree with that. I mean, I think even in the standard Yahoo and ESPN format now, which is like no corner infield, three outfield, yeah, yeah, two utility, it's pretty borderline. You gotta have an empty hole there. But I think at a minimum, Loperfido is the big side of a platoon with Jose Abreu. That's what they were doing with John Singleton, who I have to imagine is, I don't know if he's getting DFA'd or what. Singleton, it just hasn't had the career I think he hoped he would have, but they don't need two left-handed first basemen. So I think that Loperfido is going to come in. He's going to at least play against every righty. He might get some time against lefties. I think that's going to depend on what the strikeout numbers look like, what his swings look like against the right-handed stuff. But he's definitely worth an ad again. There's big, big, big pop here. There are contact problems, but we'll see how that plays out. It's possible that if he can stay, I think at like 28 to 30% strikeout rates in the majors, that should stay around. Now, once you start getting to 35 or 40, it's really tough to stay. You've got to be like an Ellie De La Cruz level freak for teams to really suffer through that and watch you strike out that much, or just have no other options. But I think Loperfido will get that long look. I think he's definitely worth at least watch listing in your 12-team league. Again, it's hard in a lot of 12-team leagues to just like stash hitters. Mostly you're burning through streaming pitchers, but if you have room for it, this is a better stash because he is sort of, you know, it's imminent. He's here now. He's being called up. He's ready to play. I probably like that stash a little more right now than a player who's probably much, much better, which is Junior Caminero, who has seemingly avoided another quad issue. He did sit for a game. He's back now. I'm just worried that Caminero, and Sarah, I don't know if you have any closing thoughts on that, but I'm just worried even if he gets called up, he's not going to play that much, right? Curtis Meade is hitting finally for the Rays a little bit. They just move all these pieces around. They don't really have an open spot for him. And yeah, I don't know if the call up is imminent. And if it is, I don't know how he plays every day, especially with Josh Lowe coming back. I mean, they just have a lot of pieces that they want to try to cram into that lineup.
My biggest concern about Junior Caminero, who I am stashing in one NFBC league, so I'm not out. Like I believe in the talent and I believe in the skills. I don't love guys like this for the worst. I feel like it's so rare that the prospect gets the call up and the job and he's not in a platoon and he just like gets the run. And I just worry that the Rays are not going to give us what we want from Junior Caminero, even when he comes up. I worry that it's going to be like some weird, he's up for 2 weeks and he goes back down, or he's like in a platoon, or you know what I mean? Like, I don't trust the organization to do with him what I want them to do, given the investment and given where he is on my roster and how long I've had to stash him. So I agree with you that I like the Joey Loperfido. Is it Loperfido or Loperfido? I don't actually know. I've just been reading it. I like his circumstances more than I like Junior Caminero's circumstances. I like Junior Caminero's skills more than I like what Joey is giving us. And I just think that I trust the Astros a little bit more to give him run.
Yeah, we've seen the Rays let guys just like once they get called up, play like a certain player who is now very, very far from the major leagues. But weirdly, the guys who they do tend to bring up and just play all the time are like friggin' Jose Caballero, because they need a shortstop and he's like their 20th ranked prospect or whatever. And they just let him play. Guys that can field well, they just let him play. Right. But like hitting prospect, like Curtis Meade, you know, again, you know, Curtis Meade isn't like this quite the same level of hype as Caminero, but he's like a top 25, 30 prospect in his own right. And they just did not care about letting him, right? Like they didn't last year. They didn't this year. They just didn't care. They had Jonathan Aranda last year who came up because he was hitting really well in the minors so that he could sit, right? Like it's really weird. Like the Rays give a lot of guys this Heston Kerstad treatment that the Orioles are doing right now. And I don't understand it. The Rays don't do things like other teams. So I'm not saying that Junior Caminero can't come up and just start playing. I'm just saying the Rays, like normal teams, when they bring up that level of a prospect, they say, look, you're going to get a shot. And if it doesn't go well, they're going to, you know, the Jackson Holiday type treatment. If even it doesn't go well, we'll give you a chance. Or like the Anthony Volpe. Look, as long as you're not completely outmatched up here, we're going to let you hang in. The Rays aren't normal. They're not. They don't do things that make sense all the time. Like Richie Palacios hits like second or third when he plays, like every time, right? Sometimes he leads off. Like he's like the fourth best leadoff guy on that team, right? Like they have so many other guys that could do this and they pick him. Don't ask me why. There's no sense to it, right? He's not like some known prospect. He's like he's a lefty who hits righties okay, right? With basically like very, I mean, he had a decent like little 32 game run last season, but like he doesn't have a long track record of big success in the recent minors. He's on his like third team. It's hard to, you know, when you're really, really good, you don't get traded that many times, right? Like you can be, but yeah, especially in your minor league career. Like, but there he is hitting first or second when he plays because the Rays do weird stuff.
Richie Palacios does have the fact that the Cardinals traded him going for him. So this is another.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
This is another. The Cardinals cut bait. I'm telling you, like, scoop up all the former Cardinals outfielders, people. They're rocking it.
God, they have an okay outfield, but like the best outfield they've ever fielded is the one they chose not to field. Right.
Can we talk about the fact that they were one player away from trading for Juan Soto and the holdup in that deal was Dylan Carlson? And I rest my case.
They do just enough to like be competitive sometimes. I mean, not so much the last two, like this year. And I don't know how they're going to be this year, but they're a weird, like the Cardinals are a weird team in that, like, they just don't keep the guys they probably should.
No, they keep all the wrong guys. They're just like, you don't put the Cardinals away, so we're done. And I'm telling you, like,
when they get rid of everybody good,
when they sent Jordan Walker back to the minors this week, I was kind of like, oh, Jordan Walker is going to be the ALCS MVP in 2028.
They're going to move him to somebody for nothing. And he's going to break out because I don't know what they do because their outfield's still kind of crowded. Like they're still kind of crowded, even though they've traded away everybody good, except for Lars Nootbaar. Like they just trade them all away. It doesn't matter. It's weird. But you know, it's been a long time recording here, but it's been an awesome time. Sarah, I'm so glad you could be here with me to talk for, you know, coming up close to 2 hours about baseball here on this Sunday evening. But I think we covered a lot of ground. It's going to take me forever to edit this because I don't have Joe to help me, but I'm going to do it. And it's going to be actually great to re-listen to this because I've had a ton of fun. Sarah, if you could just remind everyone where they can find you on the website formerly known as Twitter or anywhere else, I think that'd be great.
Yeah, you can find me at BCB_Sarah. There is no H on the Sarah. You can find my Cubs writing at bleedcubbyblue.com. You can find my podcasting for fantasy purposes on the Pitcherless Network at Fantasy Feud, at PL Fantasy Feud. And I write a column at Baseball HQ once a week, too. This has been so fun, Scott. Thanks for having me.
yeah, again, you're doing a lot of great work all over the place with real baseball, fake baseball, like we're talking about here. It's all a lot of fun. Check out Fantasy Feud. You know, my episode's out there from a while ago, but you know, they've had some great guests. I'm a big Shelly V fan. She's the one that turned me on to Tarek Skubal, changed my life. So I owe her that for, you know, the rest of eternity. But again, my name is Scott Chu. This was Sarah Sanchez. This is the Hacks and Jacks Fantasy Baseball Podcast. I'm not going to do Joe's sign off, but I am going to say, I hope you all have a great week. Hope that, you know, I'm just going to do it. I hope that all of your fantasies become realities. Have a great day.